It's slumber party time, pillow frighters. Since this is the last episode of our broadcast horror month, we are really going to channel the Halloween spirit as we are halfway to the best holiday of the year. And what better way to do that than with WNUF Halloween Special? Yay! So let's get into it.
I had never seen this movie.
Second time. This is the first time that we have seen it, and your millionth time, right?
Right, because we're uncultured swine. And
true.
No. It's just I'm a person who loves traditions, and this movie and Ghostwatch are a double feature in my house every Halloween. Like, it's a tradition.
I can see why now.
Yeah, we've gone through all of them, but the way that they both take place on Halloween, that definitely makes sense. Like, there's so many movies that take place on Halloween, but how many of those movies are you part of the experience?
Right. It was a lot of fun. The commercials in particular, I think, were my absolute favorite part of it. It made me miss the simpler times.
It's an interesting thing how the nostalgia for basic TV, like, I don't know about you guys, but growing up, I grew up in like the woods of Maine. So we had three channels. We had 2, 5, and 7, ABC, NBC, CBS. So all of those local style like commercials felt very nostalgic for me.
No, I actually have a playlist that I fall asleep to at night, and there's a bunch of like 90s commercials, Halloween commercials, Christmas commercials, because I don't know if you ever get into this place, but sometimes I get so nostalgic and just wanting to be a child again that watching those just makes me cry. Like, it puts you in that place of just utter joy and happiness. And I think that's where this movie, I think, was my favorite part, because it excelled. How he did that was perfect. I thought they were real.
Perfect. Are you asking if three grown women who like to pretend to have summer parties and be teenagers, if we wax nostalgic?
Wax poetic about nostalgia?
Yeah.
Okay, maybe it's Midwest specific. I know that like everyone has those commercials, but if I'm in a group of other Midwesterners and I go like 588-2300, like everyone will say like Empire.
Oh my gosh, Empire. Yes. Yeah, did you have one, like a local one?
Like, there's something where there's a jingle that everyone grew up with, it. Everyone knows no matter what. It can be like a little bonding moment. I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to like go to rooms where I don't know people and just start singing the Empire jingle, maybe that's how I should meet people from now on.
I agree.
But especially like the carpet commercial, that's shag carpet, not shag carpet. I don't know a lot about carpet, but like that guy did. Everybody knows a commercial that's like ingrained in the back of your head that like comes up. You're like, oh my God. Yeah. And like, that's like, I mentioned when we were filming, when they were at the hayride, and I went to a place called Apple Holler every fall season to pick apples, to pet goats.
Apple Holler.
Wow.
Sorry, I just like the way it sounds.
Adorable. But that we grew up with that. We all had that place we went to. So these commercials weren't just specific to the broadcast television of the 2, 5, and 7, which I had too. They were specific to most people's childhoods. They were locations that we knew.
There were two, just a quick shout out in case anybody's from Northern California, from Sonoma. Do you remember Scandia? All kinds of fun wrapped up into one. And then we had Windsor Waterworks. You're gonna get wet.
That doesn't
nope.
Translate.
Nope.
Singing it out loud, that made me feel really weird. But anyway, I don't know if those are still a thing, but I need to know.
But I think that's part of the immersive experience, is now you're recalling something that is already very familiar. So it puts you into your brain being like, oh, realism, this could be happening, this could be something that you watched.
And to me, something else that made this really authentic was the care that the filmmakers put into downgrading the footage to look like broadcast television. Like, it's not high def, it's, I don't even know if you could say it's standard def, but it's nostalgia.
Yeah. If you didn't know what this was and you just stumbled across it, you would think it was from the 80s or 90s.
Or when you record over a VHS too many times and it starts to get like kind of weird. That's how it came across to me, is like, this is not the first run this VHS has seen. Like, someone taked over like their mom's Matlock episode to record this Halloween special. We mentioned while filming, like, that I thought the teeth reminded me of what disturbs me about AI images, where the teeth yes. just look like so jacked. And their teeth looked weird, and that it reminded me of, like, her face at one point reminded me of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, because of...
You're only seeing the eyebrows?
Yeah. And it looked like it had that furrowed brow that all the Buffy vampires had, where it's just like...
angry. I'm okay with that.
But I love that care went into it. Like, I could have been watching this on a VHS, and it makes sense.
Did your parents ever, like, okay, so this is something my dad did, is he had two VCRs that he would stack on top of each other, and he would go rent movies or something on TV, and he'd, like, put in his movie and then push record on the second one so he could keep, like, my dad was, like, the earliest form yes! of pirating. And it sometimes it would look like that if it was a tape that was, like, you know, because you had to tape over the little things on the inside to keep it, to let you pirate it, basically. And, you know, it would look janky.
I mean, I did that with my with songs off the radio. I didn't, you know, I didn't have CD money, so
with tapes,
I wasn't allowed.
Yeah. And then you had to press the record button and you'd record Backstreet Boys like 12 times in a row.
Right. Before I joined the Pirate Bay or like LimeWire.
Napster.
Yep. That is what we did. But the way that they made it, I think it also added to the creepy factor, because you're like, why is this so wrong but so right?
That uncanny valley thing that a lot of analog horror does, which I don't know if you've seen a lot of analog horror, but it's creepy as shit. Oof, that stuff gets under my skin because it looks so just off.
Yeah, it makes me want to try that uncanny valley makeup, but anytime I see it on someone, I'm like, nah. It's upsetting. It's very like old school video game, like Doom. It just has that nostalgia built into it. They took that extra care to make it seem so, you know, it's something that you got from a friend who stole it from their friend's house, and like now you're watching it at a slumber.
Illegal. Yeah. Or it's just, it just seems like it's just.
It's like if he found the ring tape for real.
Oh my gosh. Which would be very upsetting. don't trust strange VHSs, kids. That's
if you know what a VHS is.
Yeah, but because we've seen so many different types of broadcasts, you know, Late Night with the Devil, but it still was shown in, you know, 4K HD. Right. The whole thing was shown that way. And Ghostwatch was also still very, it was clean.
Yes.
It was very clean. And The Cleansing Hour, of course, because it's modern. So this was the only one of the broadcast horror that felt like it was broadcast in the way we would have watched it. Yeah, we would have watched it at the time.
You can really tell the passion that went behind this, because it really, down to the detail, was exactly something that you would see at the time. And I also think that the budget came into play. That's where the budget came in handy. I feel like the limited budget, I should say, worked to their advantage.
Yeah, the indie film of it all,
right,
worked well.
Yes.
Which is one of the reasons I think that a lot of indie filmmakers go to found footage in the first place, because you can work on this lesser budget, and that way you can still get the aesthetic and get the vibe and get like the general idea of the film you want across without having to spend money. But this is something that I would show other filmmakers, or like I would tell other filmmakers to watch, be like, if you are worried about not having a budget, look what they were able to accomplish.
Right.
It's not just about like how much money you have. It's how you use it.
Exactly. And they used it well.
So you said the budget was like around $1,500.
Yeah, around $1,500. And I believe most of that was they bought stock footage, tons of old stock footage. And that's what they made their commercials out of for the most part. I know some of the other commercials, like a few local Baltimore filmmakers made, like Jim Branscombe, who's does Cinematic Void in Los Angeles now. He did the Party Till You Die one or something like that.
So many drugs are bad.
Oh, I thought commercials. That was so good.
Oh, but that was the so good. Of the time. Yeah. You know?
The dare time.
Yes.
And, you know, a little past the, it's 9 p.m. Do you know where your kids are? It's 9 p.m. Your kids are doing drugs.
They're doing good in plenties. If you saw, you know.
I like the way that they involved certain things in the times, like the costumes. You know, of course, we probably saw people dressed as Elvises. We saw people dressed as, there was a Dorothy. I mean, like, TM, like, the, not a Dorothy, but a Dorothy. Right. And there was, like, a cabaret glitter devil. Like,
oh, I don't know. The pumpkin, and then the very the adorable
pumpkin.
Nosferatu.
Oh, she was so cute. Oh, my God.
He's Nosferatu. My favorite.
He was so good.
He was so good.
Bring him back.
Bring him back in everything.
Yeah, he needs to make an appearance in the third one.
Another thing that I really loved was, and it's something that I personally think that Chris is great at, is he's very good at characters who are like not the Warrens, but they're the Warrens. I like that was so, I love them. And they're a cute cat. R.I.P.
Oh, Shadow.
Rip Shadow. Spoilers, but oh well.
Just so you don't have to go to
Does the dog die?
Does the dog die?
Which I did was like, did we look at Doug? Does the dog die? We did it for you. Yeah. I mean, that one actually did have a couple. But I will say, just comparing Ghostwatch and this, are like these two are more easily comparable than the other movies we watched, than Cleansing Hour and then Late Night with the Devil. But they were very different in the sense that it was British television versus American television. And I would not say that they are the same movie at all. It was a very different vibe. There, of course, there were some similarities, but the similarities were what you would experience with any Halloween episode. You know, of course, you're filming outside. There's going to be a throng of people.
Right. Well, and especially back then, 87, right? It was supposed to be 87. Of course, you're like a celebrity if you're there and you're behind the newscaster.
I love that one guy that literally the whole time.
He was, yeah, there's always the one person that's just
there's always that one asshole.
Yeah. Just trying to get through. But yeah, I see actually more similarities to, I forget, I should have looked up the name of the episode, but Tales from the Crypt season 2. There's the news broadcaster episode, because have you seen it?
No.
Oh, we gotta watch it. But it's that similar setup where, you know, it's that kind of like, we gotta get the story going in there, but it turns out, I mean, it's obviously the payoff is different, but oh gosh, it was so good.
Well, I think a lot of the differences that I noticed between, at least between Ghostwatch and this, were, like I said, because of the like the British versus American. And I think that's something that you see in a lot of horror in general, is it's very dependent on the location. You know, where we see that like horror from Japan has a different aesthetic, but it's also not just that, it's based on their cultures. And I think one of the biggest differences, like we said, with the audiences, specifically the audience here, was all about like, I'm super hyped to be here and I want to be on camera. Yeah, these people were murdered and it was awesome. Oh, yeah. Versus the British audience was very much like, this was a tragedy of our time and I am so worried about our children. I'm not even gonna pretend to do an accent.
Do it.
And but also the way that the newscaster spoke during it, you know, the British one, it was obviously we want to keep going and we're doing this for ratings, but it was never so apparent. But for the US version, that Frank dude was like, I don't care what happens, we are filming, do not you dare cut.
He was not nice.
No, yeah, he was also a dick.
I kind of love
you.
Him,
I was trying to be polite, but thank you.
I'm not going to be polite. That guy. Oh, you do you believe in ghosts? Yeah. Well, that's stupid.
Like, yeah, he's like, oh, do you? He was like challenging, like heckling these people.
To me, he came off more as like frustrated, as like a journalist trying to like curate this story and make this really good special. And like, he's like, do you believe in ghosts? People are like, nah. Baba Booey, you know, like, Baba Booey. It's like him. I felt it was more his stuff. It was dickish, but I felt like it was a lot of out of frustration, you know.
I can see that
he's trying to take it seriously and like make this scary special that people are going to talk about, and maybe he'll get a promotion and be an anchor. I don't know.
Oh, like he can move up. This might be his chance to move up in the world. Maybe his last chance.
Maybe he'll be in Whiplash later on in life. Maybe he'll be in Spider-Man. Sorry, he looks like J.K. Simmons.
Even with the stuff with the Warrens, like, you would think, you know, oh, their cat is murdered on set, and the guy's just like, well, obviously a freaking ghost did it, so can we move on? And everyone's like, or we could figure, like, wait, what? Like, someone just, like, eviscerated an animal, and you're just like, nah. Someone breaks all their equipment. He's like, as I already told you, we will talk about this later.
I like how it's not like, oh, well, we told you we'll pay for it. He's like, we're going to discuss it later with the producers.
Yeah. Meanwhile, this entire time, my favorite part is the priest. He's just like standing there like,
You called it. You called the priest.
I knew it. I knew it. Nobody stands like there looking like a thumb the whole time. I'm not saying he did. I'm just saying the expression and the way that he was just standing there. He looked like a thumb. And he just did not. Something didn't seem right.
Well, you also said like his the collar was like didn't fit. Like it was ill-fitting.
Yeah, it just didn't look right. Yeah,
I think there were subtle clues that he was right. not a priest. I noticed when they said like, oh, so you study exorcisms. And he was like, yeah, when we learn weddings and...
Oh, yeah, when he said weddings, I'm like, what kind of weddings have you been to?
And exorcisms, and that's what we learned. I was like, I don't know a lot about priesthood, but every other movie, they're like...
Well, and also, not every priest trains to be an exorcist. It's
right.
a very special thing.
It seems like something the church is kind of like, no.
And in retrospect, it's actually really funny that that was his answer. Like, oh yeah, we all train as priests.
I took a pop quiz on exorcisms, and I got like the quick certification.
It's like
online.
DMV government certificate. Yeah. You get it like...
Like, can I just go online and be like, I want to be an exorcist and I want to officiate weddings? Like, but I mean, that so once we find out is also when everything is like gone to shit. And he's like, okay, for him saying like, I'm an actor for some odd reason had me like thinking of like Star Trek. Like, I'm a doctor. Not
That's
a nuclear physicist.
The nerds. But I understand too. I understand Star Trek.
But that, like, and also the Warren, fake Warrens, the not Warrens, the not Birkins? No, that's not right.
The Merkins? Did you just say Merkins?
I said Birkins, but it was like the Bezker. I lost their name.
Burger. Thanks. The Burgers, because the cat went to chase the Burgers.
Oh, you're right. Okay, so the Burgers are like, they're gone. The cat wasn't enough. It was the equipment being lost, and then they were like, deuces.
I just love the poor intern. Our intern Connor's gonna go in. This poor like young kid's like
making so many mouth noises.
R.I.P. Connor.
R.I.P. Connor.
He's one shot of we got to see his face. At least we got to see him. I love that the priest peed all over the stairs.
I thought about Friday the 13th part 2 when Amy Steele pees under the bed, but is it the rat or the Amy? Anyway, 5 people will get that. Yeah, I loved that touch because I would be pissing myself too.
And we barely got to even see this horrible basement where all these murders happened.
Yeah. See, I loved that. You mean in the glory hole?
The glory hole.
We saw a little nod to the glory hole. I mean, it wasn't a nod, but it was there where we were like, oh, that's crazy. But, you know, this is East Coast versus like where we grew up, right. Where like you don't even have basements.
And all basements are creepy.
Yeah, there is not. Like your basement can be furnished, but as soon as the lights are off, it's nightmare. Yeah. And like my basement wasn't furnished, and we didn't have a glory hole, but we did have like a well that went to nothing. That always
well,
yeah, because like, well water.
Yeah, we had one too.
Yeah, it's just a hole. It's a hole in your basement.
The water.
There's water in there. What? It's not even like a small child could easily fall in. I was terrified that I was going to drown in that hole like all my life.
Oh my gosh.
There was no like safety over it or anything. It's just like, here's this hole in the ground. Yeah. And this like endless black water. That's what always scared me is That's like, you terrifying. Can't see the bottom. Yeah. Basements are terrifying.
Oh my gosh. Wow. We had an attic.
The basement from It Chapter One is like, it's Ooh, so yeah. accurate.
Yeah.
It is my really, childhood nightmares.
It's and especially when the water rose in the remake. Gosh. I was just like, yep, this is real.
I don't like it.
So like the fact that they were like, here's a basement. Just kidding, that's actually not the focus of this. Basements are scary because you don't know what's down there and it's like paranormal, and they did it like behind a door, which I think was a really good way. As, again, we're talking about like indie filmmaking and the budget. For the most part, all of the like actual murdery action happened off screen. So they didn't have to do the special effects. In kind of the same way, one of the reasons I think that the original Halloween stands up or holds up versus a lot of other movies from that time is because all of the kills and stuff don't happen in front of your face versus you can like see the gags in like Friday the 13th. And like at the time they looked amazing, but now it's harder. But this did that. So the only thing we see is like we see an axe going at somebody, but we don't see the axe hitting someone in the face.
And that shocked me because I had... absolutely no idea that there would be a twist in this. Not only the twist of who it is, but I thought this was a supernatural movie through and through. I thought it was like more of a spooky, oh, we're gonna see stuff. But no, it's the freaking Christians. And no, not metaphorically, it's literally there's Christians in the beginning of the movie who are interviewed who just don't
harvest.
The harvest. Heidi.
Which like probably should have been our thing is like, why did they call it the harvest?
Like, I think while we were watching it, I told you guys this, but there was like this theory, because you know how there's parts that are fast forwarded, and then they're like saying that it's like one of the Christian cult members like rewatching the movie, like as so you're the tape you have is the tape that the Christians were watching of like,
and that's why they fast forwarded over like the music and stuff.
Yeah,
see, that's that stuff gets me. I actually think that's a lot scarier than if this was just straight up supernatural, because then they're showing all the piles of the bodies next to him, and I was not expecting that. I liked it.
For they were terrifying from the get, where she's on the thing, y'all are going to hell,
demons are in the candy.
Oh my gosh, the wait, what's the band name? Goblins in the Candy. Goblins in the Candy.
But like, and it's weird because it really brings this month full circle, where we started and we are not here promoting Satanism or anything else. We started with talking about Late Night with the Devil and how it felt like Reagan era propaganda. And what would that look like to switch it around? And I didn't think of WNUF at the time. I wasn't like, this is the opposite. And then rewatching it, I was like, oh yeah, maybe it is. But I love the flip of it not being.
Oh, I loved it.
You know, the occultist like guy playing with a Ouija board, but
right.
The fucking Christians didn't want you to have Halloween candy.
Right. Usually I'm so good at picking that stuff out, but I didn't even think in retrospect, I didn't even think about the Christians coming into play. I just thought that they were interviewed, one and done.
Anyone can go to that extreme. Like right. Just in the same way that you have normal human beings who can join a Manson level cult and commit murders, you're going to have people that go the opposite way and can become so crazed and extreme in their beliefs that they need it to be inflicted. They're cleansing. It's kind of like a Jonestown level, but they weren't Jonestowning themselves. They were doing it to someone else.
And that's the scariest thing I think about it, is that legit could happen. Probably has happened. People, if they're so certain in their beliefs and they're so right, they can be taken to extremes.
And so one question I did have by the end of the movie, you know, they're in the thing and he's the duct tape. And then you finally see, she's like, get the camera off my face. And then they go to a broadcast a couple of weeks later. And it's the news anchors from the beginning. And they're talking about how, you know, oh, since the disappearance. And I was like, OK, so that last part must not have been broadcast. The last part where they're where we see the dead bodies that and all that.
Into the theory, maybe.
So the Christians maybe. This crazed group of hyper-religious people filmed it for themselves. It didn't, like, the tapes didn't go. It's not the tapes that they found for broadcast. It didn't make it back to the van. The producer, the Amy Poehler-looking producer, had cut already. Yes. So either the news station saw this and was like, we cannot let this be, or they never got the tapes and they legitimately don't know what happened to all these people and it's just, like, a mystery. But they kept it for themselves. And what was the Christians' plan? Because we didn't get that answer. So was their plan that they were going to try and blame it on ghosts? Were they going to try and blame it on the occult, but like another cult? Like what was their end game with how to hide why this happened? Who was their scapegoat?
I mean, I think that's where it plays into the found footage genre of it all, where we're not getting that answer. And I know that there's something in part two, but
oh, well, just don't spoil it, because like I want the answer to that, and if it's answered in another movie, I want to watch that other movie, and I want to go like, oh.
My favorite thing, I'm really loving how all of these movies this month have ended, like the final shot, because my favorite thing is how they're just like, nobody, the disappearance of blah blah blah, anyway, we're gearing up for the Christmas show, and then it just cuts off. I love that so much, because it's just like business as usual, trying to cover it up, just move on. Yeah. But
maybe we should ask these questions to the filmmaker.
Wait, what, is he here?
I mean, have you guys seen Poltergeist?
Well, my dog's name is Tangina.
Let's tune in. Hey, Pillow Frighters, we're joined by the man, the myth, the Halloween legend, writer, director, oddities curator, and rock star, Chris LaMartina. He's joining us all the way from Baltimore, Maryland. Chris has been a staple in the indie horror scene for over a decade now, bringing us hits such as President's Day, Call Girl Named Cthulhu, and the movie we're watching tonight, WNUF Halloween Special. Welcome, Chris!
Ah, hell yeah!
All right, Chris, so we have a few questions we ask every guest. What is the first horror movie that you ever remember watching?
Whew, man, it's so tough. I do remember the first thing that truly terrified me was a promo for Night of the Demons being on TV when I was a kid, just like all like on a commercial. Like, I think it was like, I don't know if it just came out in theaters and I was like way too young because they came out what, in 88. So I would have been like 2.5, 3 years old. But then the first horror movie that I, it's tricky because I saw things like Predator and Monster Squad when I was young. Cause my brother, so my brother's 7 years older, my sister's 5 years older. So they'd watch stuff. I mean, I saw Toxic Avenger when I was 5, and that I always joke that that kind of ruined my life. Because I thought it was going to be like Toxic Crusaders. And then like, I remember like, the first time, I think that the nudity, I think freaked me out more than anything. I was like, I should not be watching this. Like, I literally ran to like my godmother who bought me that tape because she thought it was going to be like Crusaders. She comes back in at that point, the one woman's breasts are covered again. And she's like, oh, Chris, it's fine. That scene's over. Keep watching.
Okay. So that was your first horror movie. What was the first movie that actually scared you?
So I will say the first time I remember, like, not like being like, oh God, like a thing like that, but like truly like being like, I might want to turn this off. I'll think of two experiences. I saw on broadcast of a basic cable broadcast of The Exorcist, which I thought was like really terrifying because I was raised Catholic. And that I was probably like 8 or 9 when I saw that. And that really scared me like deeply. Horror movies don't typically scare me, like even like to this day. But I remember being in the theater for Event Horizon is like, maybe I was like 11 or 12. And that was like, I might need to leave the theater. This is upsetting me too much. Yeah.
Okay. So if it wasn't Reagan, who is your first horror movie crush?
Oh my God. That's so tough. I wish I had time to prepare for these. I will say, I mean, I've always had an immense infatuation with Elvira. And I remember like when I was like a kid, like, I think that like locked in my how much I love goth women. Like, I think that's probably like the start. Like seeing Elvira, Mistress of the Dark when I was like 6 years old, that was like another very like majorly important moment of my life. But that's probably my first horror crush, I'd say.
That's so funny considering who you married.
Yeah, I was gonna say for folks listening or watching, yeah, I'm married to a horror host, Aurora Borealis.
So we've been doing this whole month of what we have called broadcast horror, and obviously save the best for last. But so WNUF is a movie that we watch every Halloween in my household. Like, it is a staple. We watch it as a double feature with Ghost Watch. And I kind of feel like you're going to tell me that Ghost Watch actually was not an inspiration for WNUF. Is that right?
So it's really funny because we get that a lot. And I feel like now it's even a weirder ecosystem because it's Late Night the Devil is part of this whole conversation now. So WNUF came out of the fact that we were coming up on 2 years where my team hadn't basically made a horror movie, right? And I kept thinking about like, oh my God, dude, like I just want to make another horror film, but unless I make a found footage movie, there's no way I can make another movie this summer, right? And this was like coming up on like the second year we hadn't taken a summer to make a film. And I kept thinking about like all the reasons why I hated found footage movies, why I didn't like most, right? I wrote this list. I wrote like, okay, well, like, why are they even recording this, right? If you buy a movie with a UPC code or if you stream something, it makes no sense, right, in that context. The other thing that I'll say there was I was also, like, the idea of, like, a found footage movies to me were so monotonous. Like, one location, minor characters, all my films that I've made up to that point and even after are ensemble films, right? There's, like, a huge ecosystem of characters. Like, really speaks to my sense of, like community. And, like, that was one thing that did not attract me to the genre. So the conceit, like, with most found footage films, you know, it's like, why are they filming this, right? Like, there's like, you know, there's, it makes no sense. So I started thinking about those things, and then a couple things that I am obsessed with spoken word, so not Halloween novelty records, spoken word horror stuff, like that's like the big thing I collect on vinyl. And there was this one thing, I'm from Baltimore, I basically grew up with all this sort of mythos around Edgar Allan Poe, and years prior I'd heard about a recording where they had done a seance at the Edgar Allan Poe house and broadcast it over the radio. And I was like, man, I've been like trying to track down a copy, like I fiendishly looked for it. I ended up actually talking to Jeff Jerome, the guy who was like the curator at Poe, and he was saying, yeah, it was broadcast, and we didn't get anything during the broadcast, but afterwards all the tech guys were like, after we recorded, they heard all this crazy shit playing back tapes, but the recordings are like long gone. But anyway, I'm getting way, way, way far away from your question. So that thing stuck in my head, and the idea of making a found footage movie. And I wrote down, and you're going to hear my cats because I haven't teed this up yet. We're living in a hotel right now with two cats because we are renovating Melissa's bathroom. So if you hear cats yowling for food, it's this is my life at this moment. And also, if you're watching this, that is not any type of art I would have in my fucking house. There'd probably be a picture of Freddy Krueger if we were in my in my house right now. But okay, so there is sort of this thing that, like, culturally, that the broadcast from a haunted house, right? There's this old radio show, I forget what it is, but where somebody does a live broadcast from Frankenstein's castle, and then Frankenstein's, I think it's from like the 30s or 40s. There's obviously, I mean, this probably was more of an influence Television Terror, the episode of Tales from the Crypt, which, you know, was the comic, and I'm a huge horror comic fan. But Ghostwatch was never, and I'll go down my found footage list in a second, but Ghostwatch was never really an influence because, one, I didn't know it existed. I mean, I don't think it was even commercially available in the United States till it was on Shudder, right? That was not the kind of thing that would have been in like a Catalog of Carnage or like a Video Search of Miami. So I think it's always weird. Like, it's always made me a little sad. Like, man, one of my moments that always broke my heart was somebody I really liked was, oh my God, was it Adam Green, I think, when WF came out, was like, oh, is that the one that ripped off Ghostwatch? He like said that on his podcast. And I was like, dude, what the fuck? Like, you're like, I think you're so cool. And like, I don't know, I'm so not familiar with that. And ironically, years later, a podcast I was on had Leslie, the director of Ghostwatch, and I on together, and we got to watch each other's movies. And because I didn't see it till I was like, oh shit, I'm gonna be on this podcast with her. Like, I really need to watch it. It's really great. I think they're very different, big time tonally. I mean, let's not even talk about budget. Like, she had a fucking network, but like, I think hers is, if you're looking for a horror scary thing, I totally get it. If you're looking for more like nostalgia and just sort of like a weird like just vibes, I think WNF is the. I think. The WNF movies specifically have been sort of like what I would like to consider like you could half watch, if that makes sense. Like, and like, I like that because as someone with ADHD, like, I feel like that's like something that really speaks to like the I've watched a lot of garbage movies. So, okay, but to go back. So we had this list. I was like, all right, well, why are they, you know, the moment I realized what we could do, it'd be a TV show broadcast for a couple things. Like, one, I realized like, okay, if it's a TV show broadcast, and these all sort of happen in tandem. They have to keep filming when things are fucked up because it's ad revenue, right? They're like, no matter how bad things get, they can't go to black because dead air is like the biggest no-no, right? And then I was thinking about stuff, the idea of like, okay, even if we have a smaller cast, the whole idea of like breaking up the monotony. Oh, here we go. Special guest star, Ezra.
Aw.
But anyway, so, but the other thing was that idea of breaking up the monotony. I was like, if it's a TV broadcast, it would have commercials. And there was sort of this moment where I was like, holy shit. And I was working in advertising at the time. I was, I think I was still a producer director then, but then I, like within the year after WNF, I was the creative director at this digital agency. And all the things that they would never let me do, I was like, oh my God, I will write all these dumb commercials. I will like drown myself in puns. Like, it was a really, really fun experience. But the commercials was the moment where I was like, I'm stoked about this movie. And I thought, I was like, nobody is crazy enough to make a movie like this. And I have a joke since then. I was like, dude, we're the crazy nobodies. Like, I'm going to make a movie in a time where people, you know, at least in Baltimore film circles, bragged about shooting their movie on a Red. We shot a movie that was standard definition. And I was so obsessed with like, you know, like the Satanic Panic stuff and just old, like, I mean, before we wrote WNUF, my godmother, who got me that Toxic Crusaders tape I mentioned, had all these, like, she had like 4 hours news recorded of when the Challenger explosion happened, right? So this is like, my godmother partially raised me. Like, I spent so much time with her growing up. And like, I went to her house and got all these local UHF broadcasts of stuff as inspiration as I started writing the treatment, the beat sheet. And it was such a special experience. Like I remember going back and watching old episodes of the show called People Are Talking, which is a local show. And like, the topic was like, if your kid's wetting the bed past like, you know, 5 or 6. And it was like, this is amazing. Like, this is just like such a time capsule. And the commercials were, it was just so inspiring. But the third thing I brought up with the found footage stuff was by putting a movie on VHS or by putting a movie on DVD or streaming, you know, it's not real anymore. horror. And initially what I thought about with WF was like, okay, if we make it look like a crappy old bootleg tape, like the VHS part of it, like shooting it standard def and like basically distributing it in this weird way only on VHS at first. I mean, initially the first couple months we're literally leaving VHS tapes in the bathroom at horror conventions or like throwing them out the window or leaving them at thrift stores. And there, we'll probably do like 50 or so tapes that were like done like that. But like that whole idea was, and putting it on torrent sites, because if you go on a torrent site, like it was on CinemaGen for a long time, it probably still is, you would be like, oh shit, like it feels more real. And we put it on CinemaGen with a fake explanation. It's like, oh yeah, my godmother Lulu brought taped this for me back off TV in the late 80s. Like she's the best. And like, so I think initially somebody even commented like, thank God for Lulu or something. That was so sweet. But yeah, so that's like the long story of saying that. Like I think Ghostwatch is, I'm certainly not throwing any shade there. I think Leslie is a beautiful human. And I think Ghostwatch is incredibly impactful. So I just don't want people to think that I was like so many times I'll get reviews where they're like, oh, they just wanted to rip off Ghostwatch. Or like, oh, they're just an American, you know, doing the American version of Ghostwatch. I mean, I do think it's an American version of the same, that it's dumber and simpler, you know, but like also sleazy and more exploitative and in a different, you know, sort of more capitalist way. So.
Yeah, that's funny that you mentioned Tales from the Crypt, because I kept thinking about that while we were watching it. It reminded me more of that than Ghostwatch, actually, that episode. I think it was like season two. But this was made on like zero budget. It was $1,500?
Yeah.
How?
Well, when you're not in Los Angeles, no, I'm just
fair.
No, so I would, what I'll say is that was like hard cost, like out of the what the, you know, the Midnight Crew budget stuff. What I will say is, I mean, we shot 40 some pages in what, 2.5 days at the Weber House, right? So there's very low cost. And I will say, if you talk from a budget standpoint, I mean, nobody got paid, nobody. So like, that's the biggest important thing, right? I mean, like, don't get me wrong, like we would love to pay people, but up until that point, the movies never made us money, like at all. And even then, like after WF has not been as lucrative, I think, as, I mean, it's been lucrative after I got in bed with some like trustworthy people like Terrorvision. But I was going to say, like, I think like there's definitely been some times where I'm like, man, like we signed really bad distribution deals for a lot of our films. Like back then when we were even just sourcing VHS tapes to shoot on, like a VHS tape I could get for like people would give them to me or like, you know, like five for a dollar or something like that. Now it's like even for the WF sequel, sourcing them for to put out on tape was like, it was bad shit. Yeah, it's yeah. But I don't know. I mean, it was truly $1,500 because nobody got paid. I mean, like I did so much of the jobs, you know, the technical jobs myself. We didn't even rent gear. The gear we shot the movie on was I used to work at a TV station, hence sort of some of the language of film that plays into how WF is paced or what they do. I mean, like it was brisk. We shot it in October 2012, Friday night at the Weber House, Saturday night at the Weber House. And then Sunday, we literally just did like two quick scenes. And we probably could have squeezed in on Friday, but we did it that way because we didn't want to set ourselves up for failure, right?
What were your initial expectations for this movie? You said, you know, you made this because you needed to make a movie, but what did you expect to come from it?
It's a really good question. So I have realized that, like, I've never been someone that says I make art for myself, because I think that's kind of like bullshit. Like, it's like nobody just like paints a painting that buries it in their backyard, right? But I have understood why there are certain things that get you so excited that you might be like, no one else is going to get like this as much as I care about it. And WNF was the first time where I was like, oh my God, like, I've heard people say this before, make the movie only you can make. And when I think about WNF, I'm like, okay, I worked in television. I fucking bleed Halloween. Like literally for the last, I mean, I've been doing it for God, probably 15, maybe more than that years. I would make Halloween mixtapes of like, and for the first, what, 10 years of it, I refused to use the internet. So there's that, there's the TV connection. And then I was working in advertising. So when you thought of this like sort of weird connection point of like making the fake commercials, having a background in local TV, and simultaneously just wanting to make the most Halloween centric film. And plus like, honestly, like the whole shot on video angle, I can't stress this enough. Like, it was not Jaws or like The Exorcist that made me want to make movies. Like, what made me want to make movies are probably two things. Seeing a version of Evil Dead on Sci-Fi Channel that's extremely edited. But the bigger push was what I will always call the punk rock, like the Ramones equivalent of filmmaking to me. And that was shot on video movies. Like when I saw things like what Eric Stanzi was doing with like Savage Harvest, or what J.R. Bookwalter was doing with Dead Next Door, or, you know, that was a shot on video, that was Super 8. But like, you know, what he was doing with Ozone or Polymorph, all those movies, there was something that was like, holy shit, like, I know this doesn't, I mean, it looks like a fucking soap opera most of the time, right? But like, and maybe that's why I loved it, because my Nana and my Lulu, we would all watch soap operas every, you know, when I was homesick. But like, but like, my whole thing was like, there's this moment where it felt real, where I was like, holy shit, I can make a movie. Like, I could totally just like get my friends together and make a movie and actually get it, you know, on the shelf at my local mom and pop store. I mean, those wouldn't go to Blockbuster then, but that was why I always liked mom and pop stores, where it really felt like you could find like this really weird, esoteric, just like really DIY type stuff. And I've always like, you know, the more and more I sort of flirt with a professional career, I'm like, oh God, you're just giving up control and then you can't be as weird as you want to be. Like, I'm like, I don't know if that's, I guess I'll just work in corporate America, which I do enjoy and I do it for a living. But then I'm like, the art is always like safe, like from being ruined by someone who doesn't get it. So, but when I went into WNUF, to go back to your original question, was like, Jimmy reminded me of this. So Jimmy, my frequent producing partner, although we haven't produced a movie in, God, since What Happens Next Will Scare You, but still one of my best friends in the world. And we wrote WNUF together. He's one of the writers with me, and then produced the film. So he told me something recently that I forgot about. And he said to me, he's like, Chris, no, do you remember? Yeah, this is what he said. He said, Chris, do you remember what you said to me when you realized this is what you wanted to do for our next film? And I was like, no, what are you talking about? He's like, he said, no one is going to like this movie, but we're going to make it anyway. And that was my mindset. Like, I was like, I was convinced I was going to make a movie that was so for me, that was just like something that I was excited about, like one of my Halloween mixtapes that no one else would sort of be into it. And then when people started giving a shit, I had this weird moment where I was like, holy shit, dude, if you make stuff you really are passionate about, you will find your, what's the term? You know, your fanatic or whoever. Like, and I think the WNUF movie was like, whenever someone says they watch WNUF like every Halloween, or say it's one of like their favorite things, or something they show to friends all the time, like, that's when I know they're like my tribe, that they're like my people. When I was going through footage to make this movie, there were just so many moments where I found things where I was like, holy shit. Like, it just felt like a kindred spirit of some of this footage we were going through. And it was also, it was, how do I say this? It was incredibly rewarding the entire time, which is not something you can say about movies very often, you know? But yeah.
So horror folklore says WNUF first appeared just on VHSs and like horror convention bathrooms and rummage bins at thrift stores or like the side of the road. What is that true? And if so, what inspired you to do that? That's so crazy.
The most often I came into that is actually two stories come to mind. One of which is the fact that, like, you know, when we were leaving it, like, I remember like Severed, like, which is like a VHS convention in the Poconos, like people would find them immediately because they collect VHS tape there. That was the one that was always like instant. But the other thing that would come back to, one of my favorite stories from that moment, and that stuff is true. We like left it all these places, right? I don't think the volume would like ever turn into someone. Like, it wasn't like I did like 1,000 of these, right? Or not even a couple hundred. Like, it was very, very limited. So like, what I'll say is, my favorite story from that experience was the year after it came out, a buddy of mine who got one of the tapes at that VHS convention, he lived in Ohio. He lived in Columbus, and he basically had this like October hit. He was friends with all these like punk kids. He was living in this punk house, and he was like, guys, I found this tape down in the basement, just says WNUF Halloween special. We should put it on. So he goes downstairs, sets the tape, but like he puts it on, and all my like his friends, his housemates are sitting there, two of which I used to play in bands with, and they start watching it, and they're like, wait, did Chris make this? So like, it was like one of those things where, and you know, the guy who showed the movie, I think that experience is like what it was like, so excited about the response to me, like people wanting to other people to believe it and trying to curate that experience. One of the early reviews of WNUF kind of joked and said, it's not so much a movie as it is an experience. And at that point, that was a point in my life where I was like, holy shit, fuck movies. I just want to make experiences, because that's like really awesome. And that's something I think about what else we're doing with the WNUF franchise, whatever you want to call it. You brought up another thing. Hold on. Let's see it. Like, I didn't take my Ritalin today, so let me see if I can even remember this. The VHS thing. Oh, where'd I get this idea? Two things come up. One was when I was at a convention in 2000. When did The Ring come out? 2002?
Is that 2002?
So when that came out, I was at a convention called, I think, Horror Find in Baltimore. And there was a cardboard box filled with VHS tapes. And they were like, Lionsgate was there as promoting, and they were like, encourage people to take these tapes. So I took one, and it was the tape from The Ring, which I thought was an amazing marketing thing. So I thought about that. And then the other thing I'd always heard, but I never knew if he actually did it. I read an interview where Fred Vogel, who did August Underground, mentioned something like throwing tapes out the window and stuff like that, which I always thought was like, you know, brilliant because we did it. So those two things really like were the idea of like causing the audience to be, have the discovery or entry point to your story, even before they start the like press play, is like, man, that's so cool. I wish there was an opportunity to do more things like that with art.
So you mentioned how you know, kind of release these tapes to their own accord to be found, but you also release it on torrent sites. So if you were making this movie and releasing it now, would you do that again?
So it's interesting. I think the context of then versus now, because it really annoys me when people put the sequel or the original now on torrent sites. And I don't regret doing it then, because that the movie needed that. This cat. Anyway, we did that because the movie seriously hadn't made us money. Like President's Day made very little money. Witch's Brew, at that point, we were still waiting for Media Blasters to pay us the other half of the advance. And even then, the advance was like a third, I think, of the budget we raised, like things like that. So it was like, and I'm not talking like real numbers. Like anyone who listens to this who makes like $100,000, $200,000 movies or $1 million movies, you'd be like, oh, wow, I could like shoot a fucking bar mitzvah and you know, give you more money than these advances. But what I'll say is, the like Witch's Brew, I think the advance was like $4,000, right? So my whole thing was like, okay, we're gonna make WF for zero money. I almost had this joke at the time where I was like, if we can make the budget back from the ticket sales of the local premiere, then fucking amazing, you know? and I kind of thought that was like, I was like, oh, surely we can make back $1,500 at one local screening. I think the Whisper campaign worked because people were talking about it because they found it through these torrent sites. Now I just feel like it's kind of messed up, because I feel like a lot of people like truly do not pay for anything, right? That they torrent everything. And I get it, dude. Like shit's expensive. A lot of these movies, it's like, dude, I do so many of the jobs. You know, it's like the amount of hours when you boil it down, it's like, really, you're going to bitch about like $20 for like a copy of something, or like, I don't know.
As we've been watching these like broadcast horror movies and, you know, learning more about the subgenre and exploring it, we've noticed, especially with like Late Night with the Devil, that, you know, a lot of satanic themed things sort of turn into Reagan era propaganda, or like, you know, the Geraldo like satanic panic special where they're talking about like, you know, Satan is bad. And we sort of pose this question of what is the complete opposite of that? It sort of feels like it's WNUF, and we're kind of wondering if that was on purpose.
Yeah, I mean, tell you what. Well, I think the thing with WNUF is a couple things. One, all the WNUF movies, if I eventually make a third, like early 2000s one that I plan to do, all of them are about at the core principle, mankind is the biggest monster, and I think religion is a major part of that. Just, I think it's crazy that, like, you know, religion like is a negative thing. Like somehow that part of spirituality for certain people is the worst thing. And I think believing spirituality, like we might want to believe like in ghosts, like in something outside of our experience, like we need that to feel like this somehow this all makes sense. And without getting too philosophical, I think I just think it was important to not make it a supernatural movie. I mean, I think even the baseline of like, and way more so in the sequel with like the commercialization of media, but like there is a through line of just like capitalism and that idea of exploitation from just commerce. So like, I think like that, like just how awful human beings are to each other are really a major crux of that story. Culture builds on itself, but every 10 years, there's essentially the same things, right? Just dressed up different ways. I think like, obviously like the reason why we did Out There Halloween Megatape was the idea of having like, you know, the satanic panic stuff of the 80s and Reagan's America, all of a sudden were kind of cool and weird. And you go from like, you know, Weekly World News doing covers where like Clinton is shaking hands with aliens. Like the whole idea that just like a pendulum swing in politics can mean different approaches to how you look at the paranormal is so wild to me. And then that swung back the other direction in the early 2000s again with like George W. Bush, because it's like, you know, you have all this thing, like the rise in like more like demonic possession shows or like paranormal shows had this huge uptick again in the early 2000s. So who knows? I might explore that one day.
So I know you touched on this a little bit at the beginning of the interview, And you said you had a great relationship with Terrorvision, who you work with now, and had issues with companies you worked with before. And, you know, there's this sort of growing school of thought in the indie film community where, you know, we're making these movies for little or nothing. And as you said, like, we're doing all the jobs, we're doing every single thing. And yet these companies, these distribution companies are coming in and they're like, oh, well, we'll give you X amount of money for your movie. And you're like, hell yeah, sure, I get my money back. But then they come to you with this itemized list of, oh, we spent this to get your poster done, and we spent this, you know, for the distribution and this blah, 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 blah. And now you owe us money or there's zero money. And it basically is a scam. And so, you know, what are your feelings on indie distribution going forward?
I think for WNUF, it was to keep it cheap. One, because we didn't need to spend a lot of money and we knew how to do it all for zero. And then two, you know, it was the whole point, like, well, if we totally eat shit doing this really bizarre movie, we'd be okay. We could surely make back $1,500. I mean, look, I mean, the fact is you have this huge wide range of storytellers that like never were able to make movies like this. Right. And that's amazing. The problem, and it's not so much a problem, it's a challenge, is that not many people are paying for media. And we're like, and it's this really weird situation where even streaming services, like, I mean, it's like cable, right? It's like, how many streaming services are there now? I think for me, I have made a lot more money and it's allowed ourselves to keep making the movies, hence why we're making another like WNF spinoff right now, because of physical media sales. Like, that's the best way to put money in the hands of other filmmakers. And what I'll say about Terrorvision, I mean, I think Ryan is incredibly trustworthy. I worked with a lot of other distributors that really do what you're talking about, where it's like, oh, did I just like basically like pay for all the people that are on salary for you? This isn't even about my title making this money, but that is really what happens at a lot of these places. And then there's so much, like, I lived through some stuff, which I don't even think I'm allowed to talk about out of respect for Ryan, but with some other people that just what they did to filmmakers was awful. Like charging us wholesale costs that were more than what they started selling the DVDs when they were eventually getting rid of them, things like that. So like, I have to say it this way. It's like, you know, the joke is, oh, you know, do this project for free and you'll get exposure, right? Then you die of exposure. But what I was going to say is it really depends who you're talking to, because if you're going to have exposure from a company that doesn't promote it, doesn't have a wide net, it's not worth going with the distributor at all, right? That all said, it's worth it if you want to keep going up and getting more eyeballs. WNUF being on Shudder was huge to its longevity, right? Because I think all the weirdos that were like really hardcore and then like niche weird little VHS style movies in 2013, they praised the movie. And every year the cult of it got bigger. But like, it was Shudder and people who don't even have physical media anymore that really helped me. Like people are like, oh my God, I love that movie, you know? But what I'll say is, I mean, like, you know, elephant in the room, when somebody pays for you to streaming rights, it's an X amount, you know, X thousands of dollars for X many years. Every single time I sell a DVD or a Blu-ray, it's like, that's like hard cost that's going right in, where it's like the same people could share their account with. I mean, I'm not going to sound like a fucking, like, I'm not going to sound like Lars from Metallica right now, but like, I do think it's important to be like, shit, dude, if you like these people making movies, you've got to find a way to do that. And also, that's one of the reasons why I will never shame people who do crowdsourcing. It's one of the reasons why I still like doing it, because it's essentially testing your market. Like, is there an audience for this?
Yeah, for sure. So I want to take a second to talk about Frank, good old Frank, who reminded me personally of J.K. Simmons. I don't know about y'all, but he doesn't have any other credits. I haven't seen him in anything. Where did you find him?
Oh, Paul Feyerkamp. Yeah. So Paul Feyerkamp, who plays Frank, I will tell you a couple things to that. So we had worked with Paul. He was he played a detective in our film President's Day. That just came out on Blu-ray, a special edition from Terrorvision. So Paul was in President's Day, and I really enjoyed his company. We would like, you know, we had a kind of a slow crew on that one. And like while they were doing a lot of like light, like turnarounds and things like that, I would hang out with Paul, and he's a chain smoker. And I just found his natural demeanor so charming. What always happens if I like someone as an actor, I ask them, I was like, what's a part like you would want to play that you like would never have the opportunity to, like, you know, like what, you know. And I can't, I honestly cannot remember what Paul said to me in that moment. The reason I bring this up with Paul is I wrote the movie for Paul. Like, it was literally like, it, what would Paul's, and that's a good thing to think about with any actor, right? Like, look at an actor, be like, you know, especially a character actor is what I'm trying to say, but like, what would be the movie where they're the lead, right? Like, what's, you know, if Dick Miller was the lead, what's he get to be in, you know? If like, I don't know, but like, when he auditioned for it, because I don't believe in just giving people roles unless you're really up against the wall, he came in, we did two things. We had him improvise like a report, right? And then we also did this thing where I was like, talk to me in character. I'm going to ask you interview questions and you're going to have to interview. And I was like, what's the most memorable story? He's like, and he sort of like, Joe, gave me this wry smile. And he said something about like, oh, run this, you know, running the bikini competition and such, you know? And it was like, but like Paul's demeanor is he's such a, like a dark, dry, sardonic wit. And I was like, I want to make sure that feels, and then very, very candidly, his hair and his mustache reminded me so much of a broadcast, like an anchor that I'd always watched growing up in Baltimore. And I also thought about this. I mean, Paul was an old music guy and kind of an old hippie, right? And I always thought about Frank Stewart. And this is how I've always approached the WNF movies. If somebody asked me like a follow-up question, like some minor character, I could probably take 10 seconds to figure out where they are now, right? Because like, it's like, it's my ego. It's like my, you know, MCU. Basically, Paul, like I had imagined Frank Stewart before he went to TV being a disc jockey, like being sort of like a rock and roll DJ disc jockey. And like one of the things that I still joke or daydream about is like I would love to put like out like a almost similar to like our WNF prequel sequel record we did. I almost want to do a Frank Stewart like mid-70s radio show, like a Halloween broadcast. Yes. But I because Paul's getting a little older now, so like I feel like he'd probably sound older than he was back then. So I'm still trying to figure out like could we pitch shift him somehow without making it sound insane. But no, I mean, like, I love Paul to death. I mean, he's just been a really cool dude. And it's a shame too, he was supposed to be in the sequel more, but he was God bless him, very, very COVID cautious, and we had to shoot some of that during even after the vaccines. He was too concerned about it, so
rightfully so. Good on him. Speaking of the WNUF multiverse, you talked about the sequel. Do you have anything else in the multiverse that you are working on now?
Yeah. So we're literally, I mean, almost done production on it, but I still have all the posts to do on a spinoff. So I always joke about the WNUF movies being a trilogy, right? So, we'll, you know, we've done the 87, did 94, 96 with Out There Halloween Megatape. And the third one, I think, will be, I want to say 2004 is what I'd like to talk about, like sort of like that post 9/11 George W. Bush America. Just gotta think there's so much interesting stuff to unpack there. But I still think that I need more time to sort of gestate on that. But right now, literally, is it's not even a movie. It is truly a Halloween special. Like, if it's over an hour, I'm kind of concerned. It's called Trick or Treat with Reed Richmond. So Reed Richmond is like the sort of cult classic hero in Out There Halloween Megatape. He's played by my, as I like to call him, my third grandpa, George Stover, who was in a bunch of Don Dohler and some early John Waters films. And it is literally, quite literally, the character of Reed Richmond doing the history of Halloween, talking about the mythology behind like vampires and werewolves and like mummies and like this legend of Frankenstein. So it's like this weird thing where it's like, it's an excuse to just make what is essentially a mixtape or a background tape, but it's not like, it's not gonna be like a feature. And I think that's like I have some plans, like how it's gonna be packaged and how it's gonna be sold. But yeah, that trying to think. Yeah. WNUF, then we did the record. So WNUF TV 28, Frank Stewart Investigates Halloween. Then I did Out There Halloween Megatape. And then we're doing this Trick or Treat with Reed Richmond. But that, honestly, that won't be out till probably 2025. So
since we've been talking about WNUF and Late Night with the Devil and the other movies that we're featuring this month, what do you think of the future of this sub found footage genre that we're calling broadcast horror?
Mm-hmm. You know, the thing I think about a lot is like, this resonates with like broadcast horror resonates with us because there's like this sort of interesting nostalgia to like us growing up and the shared experience of everyone having a similar media diet. That is one of the things that I've really tried to explore with the WNUF movies. And then I'll pivot to the larger ecosystem. But like, the WNUF movies for me was like, oh, I can talk about this whole idea that like there was a collective consciousness where like half the town in the 80s only had five TV stations, right? So they had like very, very things. And I bring this back to the point that we love this stuff because it feels like a window into our past, and this sort of, it's like cinematic comfort food. I'm curious what's going to happen as kids start aging up, and what are they going to be nostalgic for? Like, I feel like there's going to be this moment, and even now you're starting to get like creepy pastas and things like that that are more like, those were essentially like the horror VHS section, right? Or like in the 50s, like I think the reason Creepshow exists is because Stephen King and George Romero, you know, read EC horror comics. And I think you'll see a lot of stuff going in the future about like dark web stuff or things weird like that, or like some sort of social media challenge. But I think what we're really losing is our ability to connect with people with similar art experiences. Because like, I mean, if somebody references a Taylor Swift song to me, like they think it's popular, I don't know that. But like, I mean, like I could talk about politics because that, I think that's the same experience for everyone, meaning this, you see the same events, not the same experience because algorithms, I'm going down a road here. But anyway, I should have fucking taken my fucking Ritalin. But I was going to say, I don't know, man. Like, I'm curious, like the analog horror stuff is cool, but I do feel like it needs to, like there's just as much bad stuff as there is good stuff. And I think that's everything.
What advice would you give like the next generation of monster kids who, you know, right now are making movies in their backyard and they see what you've done and kind of want to do that DIY punk rock aesthetic of making your own movie? What advice would you give them?
If they are doing this strictly because they love it and they just want to tell stories, and I think that is why you should do this, I would tell them to just like create as much as possible and say no to opportunities as little as possible. I mean, do the things you want to do, obviously, but I found like I learned so much, experienced so much by saying yes to everything. And not the most important thing I can say is, dude, don't wait for the money. Like, just make it cheaper. Change the scope. And like, if you have a wild voice, if you have this sort of innovative, just personal way of expressing yourself, you'll find your people. Like, you'll find the folks that like, I think it's still really special that I have people that have followed me since like dead teenagers, or like the first Shaun of Video movie I made when I was like 18. Right. What I will also say, and this is like a joke, but it's not a joke. If you want to do this for a living, you should think about how you are going to look constantly relevant on social media. And that a lot of times means doing something like almost being more of like an influencer versus just your artistic voice, which is a slippery slope, because the more you're getting better at PR for yourself, how much time are you injecting into your craft? It's one of those things where that is the, like, people look at your followers now and they think about, who do they give deals to? You know, or like people look at like, well, if we put them in that movie, they're a terrible actor, but if we put them in that movie, that'll have X amount of analytics to turn into number of sales. That's why I don't think I've ever wanted to pursue this as a career, you know? And I hate saying this because like there are people that should pursue it as a career, that have a passion, that can't do anything else. But like, if it's someone is young, I have to tell them like, dude, enjoy your life. That should be this. And if making art and enjoying your life like have to be running parallel, then okay, do it. It is art. At the end of the day, it's art. And like making art should be fulfilling of itself. And I don't think it's insulting to have a full-time job while simultaneously doing it. It gets difficult. But I always used to joke, you know, you have to have something that lines your wallet and you have to have something that lines your heart, because otherwise you'll be in deep shit. Yeah. I don't want this to be distressing though. Like I can't stress this enough. Just constantly make stuff. And like, you got to find time to do it, because it's, I mean, for me, it's like a drug, right? Like, I could either, you know, work all night on something that excites me like that, or I could like, you know, get drunk or smoke pot or something. But like, I have found the most constructive use of my addictive tendencies has been making art. And I feel like there has a much better return on its investment.
So you also have a amazingly talented wife, Melissa, and you work on her show and her movies and also your band and live theater as well. I mean, you're doing so, so, so much. What else is there?
Okay, so I will start by saying I have a big boy corporate job. I'm creative content manager for a large global company. And that's been a really neat experience. Before that, I was a creative director at a couple different ad agencies in Baltimore. And I think going into house was like actually really interesting. And like, I find the whole ecosystem of agency life and it being in-house marketing very fascinating. So I do that. That's what, you know, is pays the bills, pays our mortgage, why we can live in a hotel while we get something renovated. And then outside of that, Melissa and I, so we play in a surf punk band called Beach Creeper, which is like literally all our songs are about cryptozoology and monsters like at the beach. And we have a record that's coming out this May called In Surf Of, a little homage to Leonard Nimoy's In Search Of. But yeah, like literally like songs about Bigfoot, songs about, you know, Dracula putting on suntan lotion, things like that. And then what else do we do? I mean, Melissa is a horror host. She does Shocktail Hour, and that is an in-person event in Baltimore. But then she also does a lot of the special features like for Terrorvision releases. And then she hosts, but the big thing she does is host Blobfest every year. So every July in Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, where they shot The Blob, she hosts this big Friday night run out. So, you know, in Blob, when The Blob attacks the movie theater, everyone runs out of the movie theater screaming. They read you the running out of the theater screaming every July. And we do this big stage show where she hosts it. Our band is like her backup band. I do all these segments because on our Shocktail Hour, oh my God, and I'm so insufferable when I do this. I'm party werewolf. So we put crepe hair all over my face, and like Melissa dreads doing it because she knows I'm going to complain the whole time while I'm getting crepe hair on my face. But yeah, so we do all these videos with Party Werewolf it's like a super fun time and like it's such a special festival. But she's been hosting a lot of things like that too, like Terrorvision Fright Fest. And then what else do we do? I used to own an oddities museum in the back of a record store, but it's currently in flux. We're actually moving out up to this area of Baltimore called, or this area of Maryland called Havre de Grace. But that'll be reopened again in, I think, this fall. It's myself and this guy, James Taylor. We're combining collections. James Taylor used to run the American Dime Museum in Baltimore, and he has some amazing things. But yeah, if you want to look it up, that was called Dr. Gloom's Crypt of Curiosities. It's still on Alice Obscura, but it was like totally like very cheap, very homemade, very folk art.
Oh, that sounds so cool. I love that. Well, aside from all of that, what is coming up next for you?
So the latest thing, and you know, it's funny. I realized I didn't even talk about the Amanda the Adventurer stuff. Like that's probably the biggest thing. And I like totally glossed over that. Melissa, my wife, wrote Amanda the Adventurer, which is this horror video game. It's like analog horror video game that's done really well. And we're actually both about to start working. Well, she's already written the sequel gameplay, and we're about to co-produce and co-direct the cutscenes for the sequel. So that's another creative thing we have going on. But what can you expect next? I wrote a movie that Melissa directed last year that is just getting finished up, but I can't announce the title or what we're doing with it yet because I'm not allowed to, which is a shame because I would love to talk about it because it's really fun. It's a horror comedy. It's really, really fun. And Melissa and I actually both act in it a little bit as well. And it's I'm really excited about that because that's her first feature she's directed. And she basically produced the vast majority of it. She kicked ass. But then the other thing we have going on, Trick or Treat with Reed Richmond, or if somebody hasn't seen the WNF sequel out there, Halloween Megatape, you could go on our website, wnuf.bigcartel.com. And you can buy all kinds of stuff on there. And then what else? I don't know. I guess that's the major stuff. I mean, yeah. This is kind of, you'll get a kick out of this. I turned 40. Not this April, but next April. One of my dreams is to shoot a 4-day feature before I'm 40. So I've literally been, that's what I've been working on, doing some idea book stuff for that all this week. So yeah, I'm that is going to happen. That is going to happen before this time next year.
Oh, that's awesome. I can't wait to see that. We really love WNUF and we can't wait to see you guys' new one. So yeah. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Oh, absolutely.
We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks.
All right, ghosts and ghouls, there you have it. That is our halfway to Halloween episode.
If you enjoyed tonight's slumber party, make sure that you follow us on wherever you get your podcasts and check in for the rest of our broadcast horror month to see all the other films that we discussed tonight.
Until next time. Sweet screams, everybody.
To the front! I wasn't ready!
Oh, you bitches are gonna get it now!